interest in forming a bakery here. Certainly you've had, I'm really impressed with the success you've had here on GAC. And basically, Ron invited me so I could just talk, give a bit of overview of what we do at Fundy Baykeeper, and then, you know, just give some ideas, maybe some pros and cons if there's interest in forming a Penobscot Baykeeper. And I'll get more into what water keepers are. There's baykeepers, river keepers. We have a bayou keeper in Louisiana. There's all sorts. But, you know, different water keepers operate differently. And so I'll overview the model we do. Hopefully you'll hear from, I know there's interest in hearing from Joe Payne at Casco Baykeeper. He's retiring in 2 days, but I think you'll still be able to snag him to catch his thoughts. They have a fairly different model from us, and so it's good to get a sense of what different groups do, and then if deciding if it would be helpful in the work you guys do here with Friends of Penobscot Bay and others. Building on successes like this one, and I've been with Fundy Baykeeper was founded in 2003. I've been with Baykeeper since 2009, and I've been the lead on the project, the Baykeeper, since 2011. Fundy Baykeeper is different than a lot of water keepers in that we're not a standalone organization with charitable status. We're housed within the Conservation Council of New Brunswick, which is one of the oldest conservation groups in Canada. It's 45 years old now, formed in 1969. And so the Conservation Council had been doing marine conservation work on the Bay of Fundy since the 80s. We'd done a lot of research on, the health of salt marshes, on the impacts of barriers to natural tidal flow. As I'm sure you all know, there's pretty dramatic tides in the Bay of Fundy. Where I am in the Outer Bay is a little over twice the tidal range you have here, and as you go further up the bay, of course, you get into the highest tides in the world. So we did work on that. We've done work on fisheries issues, a lot of work on aquaculture. I've done a lot of work on salmon aquaculture as well, because we have some of the densest sighting of salmon farms in the world. We have a lot, and we've had issues with illegal pesticide use. Had issues with legal pesticide use, but the legal pesticide use is bad enough, and the illegal is even worse. And we've also done research looking at sort of the ecosystem change in the Outer Bay of Fundy over a sort of 100, 200, 400-year scale to get a sense of how the system's changing. So we'd done a lot of research. We'd had a number of fights under our belt as well on specific issues, be it an industrial development or policy issues around aquaculture and other things. But we realized and decided, I say we, though a lot of this happened while I was still in grade school, but The organization decided that we really wanted a more on-the-water watchdog presence. And so in the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a decision to seek becoming a water keeper because we liked the water keeper model and felt by utilizing that model, we'd better be able to deal with the host of issues on the Bay of Fundy. So are folks familiar with water keepers? No? I know some of you are. Some of you have probably heard about Casco Baykeeper based in South Portland. And basically, water keepers, it started on the Hudson River Keeper. And basically, what water keepers are is... Excellent. Organizations that are... How I think of it is we're focused in a place, right? There's a lot of larger organizations, be it at the state or provincial level, like the Conservation Council of New Brunswick, that have staff or programs working on issues. So you could have a marine conservation person. You could have a person working on energy. You could have a person working on renewable energy or forestry issues. And what I like about the Waterkeeper model is it's really focused on having someone... usually at least one person or an organization of people focused on protecting the place where they live, so the water body they live on. More often it's rivers, but there are also coastal waterkeepers like Casco and us in Fundy. And so basically the model is that you're dedicated to that water body, and obviously the issues extend well beyond that water body, because when we're looking at, for instance, looking at aquaculture, we have in Canada, we have provincial and federal regulation, right? It's not like we're just totally focused locally, but it's coming from sort of a local standpoint and growing out from there, and work on broad policy issues, but also on very specific items of concern, like the example with the GM, it's GM.
GAC.
GAC, I always want to say GMC, but those are cars. And trucks. And so there's over 200 waterkeepers around the world now, and basically the model we share is that you have a person identified as the waterkeeper, or baykeeper, riverkeeper, lakekeeper, as it would be, and they're publicly accessible. There's a phone number where you can get to the organization, that individual. You can report concerns you're seeing and either receive support from that organization in how to deal with that environmental issue. So I spend as much time as I spend dealing with a specific issue, I spend advising individuals or community groups who are concerned about something, because often grassroots organizing is more effective anyway, and folks who are directly facing a threat can very effectively deal with it. And so waterkeepers have a person identified as waterkeeper with a publicized phone number. We all have boats, and we conduct on the water monitoring and patrol work. And, you know, those are the two key components, I'd say, that distinguishes waterkeeper from some other organizations. But there's one, even within that, there's a whole range. There's, you know, there's waterkeepers who are conducting extensive monitoring programs like Casco Baykeeper. There are waterkeepers that someone has a kayak in their backyard with the logo on it because really they know what the issues are, and they're plugging away at them, and they're on the water on occasion to check things out, but they're not as much of a field-based organization, and there's a whole range there. So that's basically how we came about, and the model we use is, so for about 6 months of the year, I'm on the water 2 to 4 times a week, sort of conducting surveys of the shoreline in the Outer Bay of Fundy, Passamaquoddy Bay, Deer Island, Campobello area. My boat's not equipped to be running the whole Bay of Fundy. It's just a 20-foot boat, so please don't tell anyone that the Fundy Baykeeper turns around at the Bay of Fundy and goes back into Passamaquoddy Bay because his boat's too small to go much further and on most days. But it is a trailerable boat, so we go, if we need to be elsewhere, we are. But we focused our efforts on the Outer Bay of Fundy because it's so, in Passamaquoddy Bay area, Western Isles, because it's so biologically productive. And there's so much going on there in terms of aquaculture, fisheries, and other things. And there's a lot of activity and pressure there. So we've focused our field work there, but we do work on issues around tanker traffic, you know, oil and gas, transportation developments, that sort of thing that affect the whole bay, both sides. But our field presence is focused in a more localized area. And talking to Ron earlier today and looking at the map of your region, you know, that's something that should there be a baykeeper developed here, you know, the discussion of where you focus your efforts geographically, it would be a very similar sort of set of factors we've dealt with in the Bay of Fundy in terms of where we focus our efforts and try to have the most impact. So I don't know, I hope that's clear, and that's basically the model we use. In my sense, from meeting with Ron and Peter and checking out, sort of looking at websites and Facebook pages, discussing some of the issues in this region, is that my sense is I see a lot of work already happening, and that there's sort of a nice broad cross-section of people involved in one manner or another or concerned, and that there'd certainly be a community that could support a waterkeeper organization, and I guess part of why Ron asked me here was to discuss whether that makes sense. I mean, we don't need waterkeepers just because. We need them if setting up the organization helps further the issues better, and if you've got, you know, community groups that are plugging away and getting the job done, then that's fine. There are a few to have a waterkeeper, though, there are several quality standards you need to meet. So if there were to be a waterkeeper formed here, I think the key ones that would be the most significant in terms of determining capacity would be that you need an individual full-time paid, so there needs to be fundraising to allow someone to do this as their day job, and there needs to be some on-the-water capability. So that could, you know, there's possibilities for people who already have boats here to be lending their vessels to the Baykeeper cause at different times. We need to have marked boats, but I'm sure there's ways to use flags instead of stenciling on the side of the boat so that, you know, if it's fishing, it doesn't have to be the Baykeeper while it's fishing if it's a work boat, for instance. And so there's options like that. But, we've had some good discussions today. I got here earlier this morning. And I guess just really wanted to open the floor for a sense of any questions you have, and if Ron was, I think, really testing the waters to see if there was interest in using the waterkeeper model to sort of further issues here. This is new terrain for me. I'm much more used to coming and talking about one of the particular issues I'm working on.
Well, what are some of the issues you've dealt with recently?
So we on sort of the fairly tangible end, we have a big problem with large scale debris, most of it from salmon aquaculture, so cage components as big as this room or bigger that are going about and doing what Ron described ICE doing, you know, scouring the shore and being a problem both aesthetically but also environmentally, especially when there's nets and ropes involved. So
navigation too, then.
Navigation. So we're tracking some of that and have been fairly successful in getting a cleanup of that. And I think we're at the point after 10 years where there's still going to be a sort of large industrial debris. It'll still be an issue, but it's just we're getting close to having that solved because it's now at the point where losing items is potentially becoming more costly than not losing them, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure they're tied up and secured sort of is less costly than dealing with the public pressure and media around losing items. We've just started a project around submerged debris, so there's some pretty significant areas with submerged debris, boats, but mostly aquaculture components, and so we just got some funding to work with the local Fishermen's Association to try and deal with that end of it. There's been a lot of work on pesticide use on salmon farms. So that's been more of an advocacy and public role. We worked very closely with the Environment Canada enforcement team. And, I mean, it was their work, right? We weren't directly involved in the organization. We didn't know necessarily what was going on, but...
Now, let me just say, Environment Canada is the government agency, right?
Federal government agency. And so we, you know, we were very involved in making sure it was publicly known, challenging a lot of the myths that we were being put out publicly about, you know, questioning the toxicity of these chemicals and that sort of thing, and, you know, and making sure that the issue was of enough sort of public importance that it was going to be addressed appropriately in the courts. There was a resolution to the illegal pesticide use. The company received one of the largest ever environmental fines in Canada for that, but it was also, I mean, it was $500,000, but that's sort of, I mean, I'm sure that's a shadow of their PR budget annually. But still, it was pretty significant. And we've been working very hard on trying to make sure the legislation around approved pesticides is more stringent. It's been getting less stringent. And our tactic on that, we haven't had direct legal tools to use really in that. So, but we've been heavily involved in getting coalitions going and really seeing some citizens groups take off, especially in Nova Scotia, interestingly, and then of working closely with the fishery to put pressure federally. And so that's been my major issue, has been working on salmon farms. We were involved in the coalition that got the St. Croix reopened to alewives a couple years ago. So the St. Croix used to have the largest run of alewives on the eastern seaboard. It was, you know, it was, since the 1800s, the fish have had access on and off. And then in the 70s, it was proper fish passage was built. In the 80s, and then in the 80s, the stocks rebounded. We were up at 2.5 million again. And then in the early 90s, the perfectly functioning fishways were blocked by the state of Maine because the bass fishermen upriver suspected alewives of harming bass, even though it's very unlikely that that's the case. So that got, we were very involved in a coalition there to get the river reopened, and were successful a couple years ago, and we got to do one of the funnest events of my life, which was the alewife run, where we had a flotilla of boats symbolically joining the fish in their journey upriver, and so we had boats enter from Calais, Maine, and St. Stephen, New Brunswick at the same time, the only time I've ever had to put two time zones on an event poster. And since we were straddling the international border, we spoke with the various agencies ahead of time, so we had RCMP, we had Homeland Security, Fish and Wildlife Services, and Border Patrol on both sides, presumably come to support the rally. So we counted them in our rally numbers and counted their boats as part of the flotilla. But they were very supportive, and they even agreed to officially to waive the line. So if any of us accidentally crossed the line in the water, they weren't going to make us clear customs as long as we didn't touch a boat from the other country. Those are some of the issues we've been involved in. I think some of where we've been most effective, we're involved in organizing something called the Atlantic Coalition for Aquaculture Reform, which was the body I was talking about that's been quite effective, especially in Nova Scotia, at affecting the regulation of aquaculture there, but really at raising the issue of salmon farming on the Atlantic coast. It was an issue on the West Coast, but should have been an issue on the East Coast because we've been dealing with it for a long time. And we also have, you know, helped start groups like there's one in St. Andrews called Save Ocean Science, which was challenging cutbacks to government science and trying to monitor the effect of those cutbacks because it's quite significant. So where a lot of waterkeepers are involved in litigation, like Casco Baykeeper, doing direct scientific research, I guess more in the tradition of the Conservation Council where Fundy Baykeeper grew from, we've done a lot more sort of just basic organizing and advocacy work. Yeah, we do education, and we do a lot of it around. The Conservation Council worked with a Fishermen's Association to get the first marine protected area in the Bay of Fundy, which was Musquash, which is a very significant salt marsh system. And so a lot of our education work hems around that because it's a success story. It's a really good launch point because we can get people there in boats. We can, you know, it's compelling because it's governments, fisheries, and conservationists achieving something together. So it's nice to start the education work from a positive place and then discuss issues because it's much more, find it much more accessible, and it's also just more fun for me than talking about good things sometimes, especially when you're meeting with students and stuff. So we do a range, but it's if you're thinking about a waterkeeper, it's really good to look at what different groups are doing because you do have, I think you have a bit of a grounding in citizen science. There's been some work done here, and I know it's never as much as you wish was done, but my sense is you have a pretty good framework to build on in terms of citizen science. And, you know, there've been, as I understand it, there've been a lot of people in this region trained in water quality monitoring. Even if they're not currently doing it, they could potentially be doing it in the future. You have some gear, you have some cameras. You've got some, you know, you've got experience using good aerial survey work to make change. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, you might be the some of the more core scientific investigative work that an organization like Casco Baykeeper is doing might be really useful to you as well.
We think so, especially since there's a long legacy of the industrial things that took place here in the 19th and 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. And there's legacies from that. Just as GAC is one, there's the mercury coming down the river. It's another, and who knows what wastes are there at coming out of Mack Point, because that's, I know there's reviewed the dredge spoils, or the potential dredge spoils down there.
Well, we have a lot of scientists focused on the river, but not as many that we know of, that we have found.
And we're
estuary. They're more river-oriented.
We're so lucky in the Outer Bay of Fundy. We have the St. Andrews Biological Station, which is the oldest marine research stations in Canada, potentially. It's among the oldest in North America, for sure, potentially before some of the ones here or around the same time. And so we've got 100 years of temperature data, 100 years of turbidity data on, you know, right in the region we're focused on, that we haven't had to collect. And so that's a difference too, is that we've got information to work with, and even though our science has been severely cut back, we still do have that historical data, the best around in many ways. I'm sure you've utilized the work that comes out of SABS as well and Huntsman, and so that's a difference for us too.
You know, a wonderful thing here is both the universities and the public library in Bangor have kept the old 1800s till 1920 or so fish commission and sea and shore fisheries and things that occurred before Department of Marine Resources took place. And they have lots of info from back then.
Yeah.
And I haven't ever done this pull out things that are like pull out the environmental data, but I think it can be done because each researcher is carefully making note of all these things, this date and time and location. I think it could be pulled out of that. Mm-hmm. You're right about a baseline.
Yeah.
So who pays you exactly?
So my check is cut by the Conservation Council of New Brunswick, but by money I've brought in. So we have an executive. I have to raise money. Oh. And so I do that. I have a couple fundraisers every year. We have Sponsor a Patrol, which is one of the whale watching companies out of St. Andrews, gives free trips to people who give me $100 to support my patrolling budget. And when you're running a 20-foot boat, you know, it's like you can run your season off one company supporting you like that. It's incredible. And then we do events for fundraisers. I write grants and I get citizen donations. And I mean, it's not, I certainly have help. You probably know Anka Maleski. Anka Maleski, yeah, she's based in Miramichi now, but I work closely with her. She's still our science advisor, and so she helped. We
aquaculture demon.
Yes. Yes, they love her. They love her.
Are you all like PhDs in marine biology?
No, I'm from Northern Ontario, and the first time I was on salt water was when I was summer student with Fundy Baykeeper. And so they asked me to come back, and it's a bit of a sidestep. I worked in, worked in homes with adults with disabilities before doing social sciences at university humanities. And it's just, I mean, I guess for me, it's been applying a skill set around organizing to a context that it's easy to learn a lot about the Bay of Fundy because it's amazing. And if a finback chooses to swim under your boat, then you're kind of, which happened to me in my first summer, and I decided that I might not go back to Northern Ontario, you know, because a finback just swam under me, and that's pretty neat. And from there, right, so it's not all, and I've come to understand, be conversant in the science because it's interesting, but it's like I see my role as trying to make sure, because I'm in a context where a lot of the science is being done or has been done, and trying to make sure it influences policy decisions, which I think we all know it often doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. And so I see a role, like, and that's much the same role. I mean, it's citizen enforcement, trying to make sure that the existing laws are being enforced. And I think that's the core of the role of waterkeeper organizations, and so you don't need to be a scientist to do that, but you should talk to a lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Now, you mentioned earlier that the Conservation Law Foundation is the host, in some ways, to some baykeepers.
Yeah, they have the Grand Bay Piscataqua waterkeeper in... Portsmouth. Sorry, I was there once and had a great little kayak tour from their waterkeeper of that area. And then they have the Lake Champlain waterkeeper, and they may have one other, but like Conservation Council, they have waterkeepers that are housed. Waterkeepers have to be charities or housed within a charity. And so, you know, but there is, what's it called? The other level.
You mean, maybe Peter, do you remember that?
It's 501?
No,
it's, there's a,
the term.
Just call it an associate.
We'll say it's an associate. They're using another term, but there's, waterkeepers have started having another level, because being a full-on waterkeeper is quite onerous for a lot of groups, because you need full-time staff, so you need to be fundraising to have a full-time staff. And I would caution any group that if you feel like you've got a good citizen committee that's being effective, think really candidly about whether putting efforts into having an organization takes a certain amount of energy. You want to make sure that pays its due, but at the same time, having an organization is usually the way to make sure the work keeps happening after the individuals who are here right now aren't able to do it or move away or whatever. And so this associate membership doesn't necessitate, you know, the full-time staff to the same extent. It doesn't necessitate the boat presence to the same extent, but it allows you to sort of use the name waterkeeper and to be connected to the movement without all the, there's these quality standards, and there's now 13 of them, and it's these, you know, some of them are just, you need to define what the problems you want to work on are. You have to stake out the geography of the area you want to work on. You know, you have to articulate what you're doing, and you need a fundraising plan and that sort of thing. But some of them are, you know, the necessity of having a staff person, the necessity of having a marked boat. There's, you know, and things get waived. Like the Chinese water, some of the Chinese waterkeepers are on waterways where they're not allowed to boat, so they don't have to have a boat. And some of the Colombian waterkeepers don't mark their boats because they'd be shot at. So they're not going to mark their boats.
What does your little mark look like?
My boat?
The mark.
It says baykeeper with a R. Yeah. And I keep bumping into it with my rowboat, and I'm worried that if I run, it says Fundy Baykeeper, so if I hit the D too many times, I'll be the Funny Baykeeper, and if I hit the N too many times, no, you could have your logo,
oh, okay.
But you don't need to, like, this is the Waterkeeper logo, it's the gorgeous sturgeon, and mine is and you're right to challenge me on it, mine is a humpback whale, though some in the room think it should be a right whale, though I also think it could be, I think plankton or something less charismatic but equally important could be just as valuable. So it's just the word, right? So it's that when I'm out and about, it's so that your presence is tangible and felt.
It is part of this, so that when you've noticed that when people have a once they get to know you and trust you and so on, that when they find a problem, they'll call the baykeeper.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, if he can find who in the government's going to deal with it or something.
And I want people to know I'm out there, right? I'd love someone to hail me on VHF and say, come check this out, especially if they're, you know, near a whale. Or joking. We do a little bit around whale watching, like in the really heavy, when there's heavy private whale watching, we'll try and show up as a deterrent too, because the whale watchers, I find them all quite good, and they take it really seriously, and they're trying not to harass the whales, though they're under a lot of pressure to find whales. But it's when you have a lot of private boats on holiday weekends and stuff in the fall, that's when you get the collisions, because it's like, I get anywhere, I see a spout, and it's like, I go down in speed really fast, and I don't move very quickly until that spout's really far away, whereas people can be in the middle of a group of whales and then decide they're going home for supper and steam off at full speed, right? And we've had boats capsized and stuff because of that. So we do a little bit. So having a marked boat allows a degree of deterrence, and if you show up at a pesticide treatment, you know, it's just that sense of watching. And so if people see you cruising, and often I'll get a call after someone's seen me cruise by their cottage. They'll be like, oh, well, did you notice this? We've been, you know. So you want
it. What's the pesticide? Is it for the salmon?
It's for sea lice that live on the salmon. So they're a natural parasite.
It's not for the blueberries. It's not draining.
No. So that can be an issue. That's an issue on pea. Yeah. And so it's often the same chemicals. Cypermethrin is the one that they used illegally in Canada, and
killed a lot of lobster.
That's
how it became.
That's how we knew it was happening for well over a decade. We even have confidential memos that were faxed out to companies advising them on how to get away with using pesticides illegally in the 90s.
Oh,
right? So it's a long-term problem, but there was only an extensive lobster kill. In 2009, 2010, there were several. And so that's when it came to the fore. And at the time, there was a lobster kill in November, and the company whose site it was says, but they use this chemical on blueberry fields. And the response was, in November on Deer Island, there aren't commercial blueberry fields on Deer Island, and if there were, they wouldn't be spraying pesticides in November. And then they were like, oh, well, they used it on the salmon farms in Maine. And, well, then it would have had to pass through the largest tidal whirlpool in the world and remain as a tight plume somehow. But sea lice are crustaceans, lobster are crustaceans, but so are krill, and so are copepods, and so are all the stuff in the top of the water column that we're not going to find, right? So lobster is the way to get at the problem, because it's a species that if it's killed once it's in a trap, we find it, right? Anything else we don't really know about. So,
yeah. And, can I ask you something about the Waterkeeper Alliance?
Yeah.
And just the sort of generation of this whole concept and how it's developed.
Yeah.
Administratively,
please do.
I might say.
Okay. So the Waterkeeper, so there was Hudson Riverkeeper, I believe,
'90s?
Well, Pete Seeger was involved with Clearwater, which is not a direct precursor.
Robert Kennedy Jr.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy Jr.
Robert Kennedy Jr. is the one I associate with.
Yes, and so the Pete Seeger's organization was not a direct precursor to Waterkeeper, but was in the same movement from which Waterkeeper came about.
The thing about probably the biggest thing they do in the states, like the mid states, is it has to do with hog farms.
Yep.
And ponds for waste.
And on the whole Chesapeake system especially.
Oh, yeah, right.
Hog farms, and there's stuff with chicken farms as well. I've chatted with a lot of those folks, because, salmon farms are just industrial feedlots at sea, and so there's different issues on how to track their waste.
You had the same issue at one point. Were involved in a lot of this salmon farm thing, but it sort of got taken care of by the Endangered Species Act. And what about Canada with something like that?
How do you mean about risk to endangered species?
Well, that all of a sudden all these things were no longer acceptable because the Atlantic salmon had been declared an endangered species officially.
No, we have salmon farms in areas where wild salmon are endangered, but it's
a question of a specific species that they
No, they use St. John River strain, which is not, I'm pretty sure, not listed per se, but even if they used,
well,
even
the
if...
Lower, what they call the lower Bay of Fundy salmon is endangered.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, and I mean, all of Bay of Fundy salmon are sort of in the process, if not listed, I believe.
Yeah.
And so, no, that hasn't been...
That was a major weapon in terms of...
Now the impacts on wild salmon are the center of the discussion around salmon farms in Canada on the West Coast, but certainly on the East Coast, too. There's demonstrated interbreeding. which weakens the wild strains and very depressed populations. There is a potential for transfer of parasites and disease. And, you know, so there's those are all issues. But we have, I mean, our salmon farms are there. When a salmon farm is moved because of bad siting, they're given another site. So, and we've, in Canada in the last few years, we've had farms approved in Nova Scotia for 1 million fish per site, like huge, twice the size of, you know.
The South Shore, Shelburne County, places like that.
Yeah, St. Mary's Bay.
Yeah.
And Jordan Bay.
Yeah.
Which is just the other side of Shelburne Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there have been some fought off on the Eastern Shore, but they were a Scottish company, not Cook's.
Yeah.
And so, but the administrative, the questions around how Waterkeeper works are really good ones. Waterkeeper, it's not, the Alliance is a hub. It's not a service organization that serves the members in a sense. That's fair, and it's important to say that becoming a Waterkeeper doesn't mean you have money flowing from New York here. So they have great attorneys, they have great expertise, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of Waterkeepers work with Waterkeeper Alliance staff on issues that overlap with the sort of national campaigns Waterkeeper Alliance is running. They run a great conference, and they sort of, they ensure the quality of Waterkeepers around the world and help make sure that it's a strong network because it's full of members who are strong.
You mentioned once the why they needed to trademark the name.
Well, they needed to trademark the name, and there have been periods where Waterkeeper is very aggressive about defending the trademark, and anyone who's not listed, registered with them and accepted with them as a Waterkeeper, they very aggressively go after them sometimes, because we've had coal companies set up a Riverkeeper, right? Because the name has power. So then you set up, you know, it's, you get, I love the term AstroTurf for fake grassroots organizations,
mm-hmm.
right? So I wish we didn't need it, but it's a good term. And so they very aggressively defend so that if you're a Waterkeeper, it means something, right? And there are stream keepers and fantastic grassroots organizations, and there's the Skudik River Keepers out of Spiak, Pleasant Point, Maine, the Passamaquoddy group. I've made it very clear that you know, we are not going to challenge their use of the word river keeper, because they're you know, they chose that name because they are it's their river. They're the keepers of that river, and they want to be that. And so there's instances where people are using the term, but it's, if you're a coal company, you'll be gone after, and otherwise they'll just sort of conveniently not notice. But to, like, to set up a Penobscot Baykeeper, you'd need to be a member.
So, is this, like, all over the world?
Yeah, it started in the U.S. and moved to Canada fairly quickly. Now it's definitely centered in Canada and the U.S. U.S. mostly. There's only 9 in Canada. There's
in Europe, maybe?
Yeah, there's a few in Europe. We've got one guy in Russia who raps well at conferences. He's really, really funny. He tries to get his translator to translate his raps. Rap songs at the event after the last night, and then we've got one or two in Poland. We've got one in London, canal keeper, working really interesting, because working on water that's been channelized, that's been canals for hundreds of years, and looking at the ecosystem in the city of London, which is so interesting, I find. And then, but just a few in Europe, several in Australia, several in China, several in India now, and a lot, there have been a lot, the last couple years, there have been groups of monks choosing to take on the model in the Himalayas, which is really interesting.
Wow. Do you ever send your river keepers from maybe Canada, do you send them to other countries?
We have a conference where we all gather, and the Waterkeeper Alliance, so if you were a Waterkeeper starting up in, you know, in Nepal, you'd probably have a lot more support from the Waterkeeper Alliance than you're going to get here, just because, you know, frankly, you're not going to need it as much here because it's of the context we're in, and that you'd have support from your peers and that sort of thing. And so they put a lot of energy into that. Sometimes there's individuals from different organizations. Like, I've become really close to the a waterkeeper in Senegal because I speak French. And so, but we haven't done visits, but we could at some time. But that's sort of ad hoc. But there is Waterkeepers Alliance staff who support the international. And then there's lots in Latin America now, too. So it is global, still very much centered in the U.S. And it's like you go to conferences and it's like half of the sessions deal with the Clean Water Act and stuff that doesn't apply in Canada, right? So there's still, if you're not a U.S. keeper, then, you know, it's not as applicable to you, but you still, it still is a meaningful movement to be a part of. And so the alliance is there and growing the movement and organizing a really good conference and serving as a hub. You can they've got communications tools, online communications tools to help waterkeepers stay connected and share resources and that sort of thing. So it's good. It's like the first thing when we were looking at oil spill response in the Bay of Fundy, and the plans to use dispersants, the first thing I did was called the waterkeepers on the Gulf of Mexico, right? Because I don't need to track down the experts who have expertise in that because they've been working on it. So there's the alliance, but the peer-to-peer work I've found just as useful or more useful, meeting people at conferences and then calling them up. So having a relationship with Casco Bay Keeper and seeing what they're doing around coastal acidification, for instance, is way more useful than the high-level staff in Manhattan. That's nothing against them, but it's that peer-to-peer networking is incredibly, and it's meant that I've been working with groups on the West Coast on salmon farms, so we've been able to, through Waterkeeper Alliance, I think we've helped sort of bridge the salmon farming issue in Canada anyway.
I mean, Atlantic and Pacific?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it's a lot of the same issues. Different, there's key differences, but, you know, it's the same fundamental issues. So I'd say that's the strength of it a lot, is that networking, but it's not like an organization. It's not a foundation that is funding or supporting the grassroots organizations. It's an alliance which serves as a network, but it's also kind of its own NGO, and it works on campaigns nationally and has its own attorneys and that sort of thing.
Now, speaking of nationally and all that, I think one thing that I saw in here and elsewhere is that a baykeeper may be focused on just one part of the bay. That's all they have the capacity for.
Yeah. You know? And so we don't stake the whole Bay of Fundy, though we work on issues like fossil fuel transport and stuff. And I've gone to Nova Scotia to try and to meet with fishermen and stuff around tanker traffic and things that affect both sides of the bay. But I just know, like, a dump site in Nova Scotia, I just don't have capacity. I'll help people. I'll do my best to make sure they find someone who can help them, but it's like we've had to stake our territory much smaller. And if there was ever someone who wanted to be the Upper Bay of Fundy baykeeper, I would yelp hooray and try to help them and hope we didn't commit too much for funding.
Because most of the pressure on this bay is on the west side, and from Rockland up to Searsport. Mm-hmm. And there's chronic problems like over in not Castine, that there's a Superfund site just below Castine, that next island that's, or peninsula that's there. I forget what it's called.
Right near Holbrook. Just past Holbrook, you mean where the lead is?
Yeah. And however, Callahan Mine. But So one thing is that, apart from that, the two sides of the bay are so completely different. I mean, this side, Route 1, right there, and as I mentioned before, with Rockland and Camden combining their sewer departments, the Rockport coast is really under risk of heavy development.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, for us, it's similar. The Upper Bay of Fundy, you know, you might have heard of Fundy National Park or Hopewell Rocks and up towards Moncton and up into those really heavy tidal areas. It's a very different dynamic up there, and we're focused, you know, it's like we're focused in an area with a lot more sort of there's fishing the whole range, but in where we are, there's a lot heavier shipping and aquaculture, and so we just focus there.
And you've got a lot going in on having to do with like tidal power.
Yeah.
Up in the Minas Passage.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing.
A little bit around Eastport too.
And you've got a shad run.
Exactly.
That's really important.
Yeah.
That is likely to be, you know, affected one way or another.
Yeah.
By the river openings, you mean, or by the
tidal?
There's a shad run up Nova Scotia. They go up into the Minas Basin,
and they
then come down through New Brunswick. So that's on your side.
Now I wondered. I saw the Ocean Renewable something, or the company that makes those. It looks like a giant old-fashioned lawnmower.
No, that's not the Upper Bay.
No, that's the system that they're looking at between Eastport and Deer Island.
Oh, okay.
And OREC has got large, kind of like fuel quick aircraft engines.
Yeah.
I mean, props.
What?
They look like propellers, right?
They're internal. They look like propellers in barrels.
Right.
Of the large thing. And do you know Mike Dadswell?
I know the name. I've never met him.
Right. He knows about how tidal turbines chop fish.
Yeah.
A lot about it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so I mentioned that to say it's like you can set up a water keeper that's functional, right? You don't have to take on everything. I think it's better to be effective. And so it's like it doesn't have to be Penobscot Baykeeper. You don't necessarily need to be actively patrolling all the time the whole bay, right? Just like Fundy Baykeeper is not cruising the whole shore, because frankly it'd be a waste of time, because we can figure out what's going on without burning that much fuel, and so just keep that in mind, that if there's interest, and then there will be help if you're setting it up, if you're interested in going through this. I mean, your peer organizations, Casco and us, are sort of either side of you, and both also Coastal will be dealing with very similar issues, would help. There'll be a staff person at the Alliance that will. Like, people want more water keepers, and they want them to be effective. But I mean, if it is helpful here.
I'm hoping, because it seems as though our bay is getting a lot of development projects, and everything from these, steel junk places to big tanks to the march of development along pristine areas and so on. And there are all these separate battles, and it's hard to. And often what one group has learned can be very useful to another group, but they don't know them.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to have somebody who's coordinating with all these folks, but not a member of each of those groups. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's something you do, is you help these different organizations as needed. And
there's a lot of, like, tag team. There's a lot of sitting down with the Fishermen's Association and saying, you do this, we'll do this. Or getting a call being like, okay, if we could, like, a bit of media on this issue right now would help a lot. So my head pops up and I complain about something, and then there's some media on it, and then, you know, someone working the softer end, all of a sudden government's a little more receptive because it's just hit the public sphere. So there's lots of, so water keepers tend to be much more willing to do the advocacy, willing to be confrontational or willing to engage in respectful but appropriate conflict when people aren't playing ball. And a lot of organizations don't do that as much, and so, but that doesn't mean you're not working with those organizations, but you know, that's often when there's sort of groups that are well connected. It's like, so we play that role a bit, right?
It's almost like good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
You know, you're the one who's going to frighten them a bit, mm-hmm. and it makes the other group seem so much more reasonable after all.
Yeah. So there's a bit. There's issues with dredging. No, there's dredging, and extensive dredging in St. John Harbor, yeah. For instance, and there's. There's been a bit of dredging in St. Andrews. It's just, I mean, big tides doesn't mean everything flushes away, right? That's one of the problems we have. They put salmon farms in the Bay of Fundy because dilution's the solution to pollution. There's so much, you know, there's 25 to 30 feet of water twice a day, so it's like it must all just go away, whereas Passamaquoddy Bay, which is quite a big bay, over half of it is a gyre, right? So it takes 8 days to flush. Even though it's going up and down, up and down, up and down, it's still depositional. Hmm. And so that's one of the issues we deal with, is that people often assume that the Bay of Fundy flushes better than it does, where it's the dynamic of any coastal inlet. It's the same dynamic, it's just more water movement. So you don't, just because water's going up and down doesn't mean it's flushing everything out.
Well, you know, it's a pity that Representative McDevin, I hope he's okay.
Maybe next week.
Does but, he have your phone number?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I haven't heard from him, so I hope
he's
not.
It was the inauguration of the governor. I thought about it.
Ooh, is that right? We have that guy again.
Well, I thought maybe he might have been there. Maybe.
Well, he called yesterday. He said
he was.
Uh-oh. He thought this would be fun. And, well,
I just have to.
Dallas Cowboys?
I don't know. So, but one of the things that I called, when I spoke with him once, one of the things he said is the most important finding that that comes out of this commission is that there's a complete lack of info about how acidic waters are around the main coast. And that there need to be some baseline studies where you start gathering that info. Like you said, sometimes you can get older info that will be pH studies from time back as well. But right now, don't know where the hot spots are. You don't know. GAC chemical, for example, was an acid hot spot. Now they're actually going to deal with it. Thank goodness. And but what else? Where? And so you can't deal with acidification unless you know what the sources are. Because the one source everyone knows is the Midwest coal burners. You know, very little you can do here about that. But there are the legacy wastes, and then we don't know what else.
I think the acidification that a lot of people are talking about now is climate change connected.
Is that right?
So it's basically the CO2 changing the,
just the CO2 in the air will...
Absolutely.
My goodness.
That's why we have an acidification issue.
Yeah.
It's not point sources of...
But that can be part of the dynamic.
Right.
And nutrients, because nutrients can play
into it. Yeah. The thing is that what you can do something about is the nutrients.
Right, right.
And these meetings that, NECAM mm-hmm. has been holding, they had a stakeholder meeting in Maine, and they're doing them in different states in New England. And the outcome of that was a recommendation that, you know, that the groups that are worried about working on water quality issues, this is a very hot territory here, that this is where they can really do something. And, you know, a lot of this thing about the deposition is still sort of not... You can't get your hands around it that well, but
right.
you can about the water quality. And incidentally, I just wanted to mention that the Clean Water Network is getting reestablished
from way back.
They sort of went under about a year or so ago, maybe longer than that, and they're reestablishing. I'll be sending out a press release on this.
Oh, good. And so I wish he was here, but. But he isn't. So
I wish they could.
Yeah, I was interested in what he
very,
had to say.
Very good guy, and so you know, I have recordings of some of his talks, and too bad I don't have one here. We just put up a picture of him.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about the report? Any particular?
Well, the report is on the web.
And most of it was more research is needed, which can be said of every commission's task force. Always says more research and more research dollars.
Yeah.
And all that. But the only ones that would seem concrete were dealing with legacy land-based sites that exist and doing the baseline studies.
Yes.
And he said that was the most important things there. There were about 10 more other things.
Citizen monitoring.
Yeah.
And there is a network now for the Mid-Coast.
Well, I'd like to see it include pH because it really hasn't been. Oh, is that right?
Yes. I'm saying it's ocean acidification monitoring.
Oh, that monitoring. Okay.
Yes.
I was thinking of the water quality monitoring generally, which...
No. This is something that's been going on for several years now. But this past year, when we established this Maine Coast... What is it? MCOA, I can't remember. But Sarah Gladue is the person to contact.
Because it'd be great to have a talk about that and get that going on here.
Yes.
And
saltwater intertidal pH is very, very difficult. I think there's one or two people in the state that do it.
You know, it's...
I remember the protocols and so forth have been worked out in DEP, so...
Yeah, the rivers and lakes is one thing, but the
saltwater is more difficult.
And they're doing it by boat and also on the shore.
Yeah. I just have two more questions. How far did you have to come to this?
It's just like... 2.5 hours or so.
Well, we appreciate
it. Coming.
Yeah. But it was... I don't know. I think it's nice to be able to... It's just... Waterkeepers want to support other waterkeepers, and you're in a nice little corner here. So,
and now, where's your next conference?
Next conference is in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh,
it's sometimes.
Did they ever have them out of the United States?
They had one in Toronto before my time. They've had one in La Paz, Baja California, Mexico, which was really rough.
Oh, wow.
I'm joking. It was lovely. And, most often in the States. I mean, the cost of having one outside North America, since most of the people are coming from North America, I think it's tended to be here. I'm sure there'll be another one in Canada at some point.
And it's interesting to hear they have them in China, to me.
Waterkeepers, yeah.
And it would be interesting to go over there and work with them.
There was an amazing... we had a conference in Portland, Oregon, where you had... It was incredible. We attended a rally that was organized in conjunction with our conference, and there were... It was about coal, and there were folks from the areas where mountaintop removal coal mining is happening talking about the impacts, and then the next speech was someone who's on the route of the trains and having the coal ash blow off and affect rivers and streams and farms, and then there's someone at one of the proposed port locations talking about the impacts on their coast, and then the Chinese waterkeepers get up where the coal's going to be burned, and they talk about smog, and they talk about impacts of given the low quality of their coal burning facilities, the impact on rivers, contamination, everything else. So that was an incredible moment where you had from extraction to burning across the planet, you had so that was a really neat moment with waterkeepers, with the Chinese waterkeepers.
Just connecting all those dots.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was neat. It's rare that you have the whole life cycle, or most of the life cycle, because it gets into the air. And then
it sounds incredibly interesting.
Yeah.
I have a great life.
Yes.
You know, it's really significant, I think, that we're having this meeting and this conversation, because that creates another dot on the map.
That
Penobscot Bay, or Friends of Penobscot Bay, or wherever this goes, it's significant that it puts the area on notice. There is an awareness, and there is a motion here to monitor things.
And I'm getting 3 or 4 emails tomorrow, right? Being like, so how was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did people show up? Are they, are they doing stuff? What are they? And it's nice to be able to report back positively, right? Like, there's a lot more waterkeepers have emerged and been effective from less than this. A lot less than the work you guys have been doing here, so.
It'll take time, but this is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and
I think that's just very significant.
Good.
As I said,
with all your work, Ron, and how this body has come together, and look how many people we have here today.
Yeah.
You know, that's significant.
And we'll see on Fox News.
Yeah, I was like, how do I have a candid conversation about organizing, environmental organizing with them? And I'm like, is that the Fox News? I think it is.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I know, I figured.
I wondered about that.
Yeah.
I was going to go out and talk to her. Huh? Well, you know, I want to thank you. More questions? Certainly, if people are interested, sign up the sign-up sheet. If I can contact you to find out what skills are, what you're interested in, because some people are just really, really good at one issue, or some other folks are very comfortable on a sailboat, or they like being behind a microscope, and so on. And all those skills end up being hugely valuable. And some people are rich, and they're going, oh, sure, we'll help fund this or that. And whatever it is, as long as, because we know that the bay is getting, you know, the developers are coming, the industrial wannabe developers are also coming, as Pete said, the Searsport Select Board just gave a big thumbs up, right, to the to that big steel junk place.
They did?
So, Matt, they gave it a license. Oh. It still has to go up for...
Yeah, I heard we've had similar recycling, like shredding and recycling facilities.
CLF, but that worked with the EPA. Because they received over $500,000 in fines for water and air violations.
Well, they were so egregious that Portsmouth asked them not to come back.
Right, they wouldn't even negotiate. But not only there, but more quietly, even in this state. Yeah. So, where'd they come? The easiest pickings.
Well, that's the LNG story, too, right, for us. Yeah. It's LNG. They crept all the way up to the coast, and they got to Washington County, and there was some interest. And the fight on that has been because there's folks across the border in resort towns. Mm-hmm. Really, to be totally candid about it, and because the ships have to pass through Canadian waters, so we've got a bit of push on it. But yeah, it's like they're going to keep
these things keep coming up. It'll be this developer or that, or this someone wants to relicense with more lead, like the cement plant got permission to put more lead into the atmosphere, not less.
And I think that's why I think that's one of the reasons why it becomes worth it to put some energy into support setting up an organization that can stick around and sort of withstand changes in people and support a bit more, because stuff's just going to keep coming. Mm-hmm.
Matt,
right?
Well, Ron, could you support it? And our biggest challenge, our biggest polluters are all foreign companies. Do you have experience with that and you could share?
I don't. So it's Irving and Cook are the people I work with, and they behave like foreign companies, but they're locally bred, and they don't necessarily keep their money in Canada or New Brunswick, but they're from there.
You know, we worked on stopping a quarry in
you'd have more on this.
And that was a company from New Jersey that was going to extract a huge amount of basalt out of the North Mountain on Digby Neck. And that was a very large assessment, a joint federal and provincial assessment, and it got stopped. We now have a company from Alabama up near Cape Breton at Black Point. Funny thing, it's called White Point. Black Point now up near Cape Breton, and they want to even almost twice the size quarry to do a granite quarry, coastal granite quarry, that's then going to haul stuff down to Alabama.
So
that's going through. We had a full panel review on the White Point quarry, and this one is only getting a comprehensive study because in Canada they pretty well gutted.
Yeah, they've gutted
the Environmental Assessment Act,
along with our Fisheries Act, along with our Navigable Waters Protection Act, which is now the Navigation Protection Act. When they take the word water out of something, it's usually bad.
Now they may be that. I think the next election, which is coming up in this year, that the Conservatives are dropping in their support, and Green Party's coming up a little bit, but also the Liberals with Justin Trudeau is possibly could form a government. They've been talking about it will be a majority or minority government.
A really interesting thing in Canada is there is developed since the cuts to science an amazing network of scientists. So scientists are now a strong lobby group in Canada in a way I think they've never been before.
You mean like university ones or?
All retired government scientists who aren't signing their name to anything but providing a lot of information.
I've been working
with him. We had Save Ocean Science. There's Evidence for Democracy. There was formed after there was a rally of 5,000 scientists on Parliament Hill, held a symbolic funeral for evidence because evidence was no longer influencing policy. And so they held a funeral and all showed up in white lab coats. And so there's this this lobby has emerged in Canada around it's not that their claims are not at all, it's not radical at all. They're just saying, yes, you have to factor in economic and cultural considerations, but decisions need to be grounded in scientific evidence.
So you work with BOFEP a lot.
Yeah.
We're bound to see that when our EPA scientists are not allowed to, if they've done studies, peer-reviewed studies, they're being disallowed.
And that's bad in Canada now, too. You can't partner with a federal scientist in Canada without having your work reviewed by the government before it can be published.
Mm.
So now university scientists don't want to do papers with government scientists anymore because they all of a sudden become subject to an anti-scientist.
And suddenly you have
government.
Some administrators somewhere editing your reports or things.
Yeah.
So what was the big cut? I don't understand the big
cut. So there were huge, cuts beyond any cuts we've seen before. They were hidden in budget bills, and it was changes to the Fisheries Act so that it didn't protect habitat in the same way it used to. Cuts to government science. They eliminated contaminants programs. So
why
we don't.
Why did all that happen?
Why?
Because of a conservative government.
And so we have no more. We don't have we don't have a toxicology program in marine sciences or even for fisheries and oceans doesn't have a toxicology program anymore. Neither does Environment Canada. So they can't, whereas they were doing cutting, all the Norwegian scientists were sort of leaning over our shoulder watching. We were doing cutting edge research on pesticides on salmon farms. They were using dye to measure how quickly it disperses, where it goes, all that sort of stuff. Stuff that has changed the dynamic in research in the country, and then, a year later they're cut. So we've had incredible downsizing and cuts to legislation and key staff.
Your organization is even way more important.
I think so. I think all organizations doing environmental work just need to buckle down.
Yeah, and, our state we have a very conservative governor.
Yeah.
This is his second term, and second term means do it now or forget it. So, I know that, the environmental agencies, it's been profiled in the newspaper as many of its faults. And of course, as I said, and now they have sort of egg on their faces about GAC chemicals. Like the company says, oh, well, we are actually polluting out there. After years and years, the agency is saying there's not a problem there. There's not a problem. We're not going to test, but we just know there's not a problem there.
Yeah, but buckle your seatbelt because
he's untamed, unchained
business,
capitalism.
Business.
Well, that'll
lower energy costs, which it's okay as long as you don't kill everyone in the process.
All right. Well,
I think that shipping scam is gonna.
We hope so. The two international organizations I know of is Sprague Energy, is a Norwegian company, I believe.
Swedish. It's part of the Axel Johnson Group.
And a successful thing was the East Penobscot Bay Environmental Alliance some years back fended off Jorn Vad, who was a Norwegian salmon farmer, wanted to set up over on the islands over on the other side of the bay.
Perkins
Island. It's a name similar to that. There were two sets of them, but they were turned back because the people in that area, some of whom own the islands that they're suddenly having cages set around, or would have, fought hard, hired scientists, proved that the water's circulation was slow enough that you would end up with a accumulations of salmon waste below it. It wasn't going to disperse, like he said. And I think the agency finally said, well, we're not going to accept it then because evidence is fairly clear that this is not a safe place for that. So and it took a tremendous amount of work, but, you know, by this outfit. And Jane McCloskey was the head of it. Her father's a story writer.
Robert
McCloskey. And so she may be very helpful on the east side of the bay there, because they say often people are very fiercely particular of their chunk of Penobscot Bay because it's so big, whether it's Searsport or Rockland or Rockport. Rob Iserbeet, who you spoke to earlier there, you know, it's Rockport Harbor. It's just very important to him. It's where he works and what he cares about. And so, you know, I'd really think that, you know, tying together people like that is really going to be effective. And like you say, whether it's a baykeeper or we just have the friends of Penobscot Bay really get friendly, you know, around the whole bay there.
That's yeah.
Do you have a website that we can go to?
We do. It's if you Google Conservation Council or go to conservationcouncil.ca, we have a section on there.
Or just look up Fundy Baykeeper and do this. Look up Fundy Baykeeper on, what's that called, the YouTube.
Oh.
It is a great little thing. There he is rowing out to a boat, taking some people on a tour.
I had a summer student who was really handy with a camera to my detriment, I think.
All well, no. You
all
came
of a sudden,
well.
These videos start coming out, and some of them are really playful. It was great. Yeah. It was great.
You deserve a round of applause.
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. All right.
Yeah, but thanks so much for having me. It's nice to get to this little chunk of the coast. It's all the same system, so.